Okay, well, let me welcome Tom Poremski. Tom is a veteran journalist and publisher of SiliconValleyWatcher.com. Many of you, I'm sure, have read his writings for many, many years. I certainly have been following his work for a long time, and I know Tom is absolutely passionate about the subject that we're going to talk about today, which is the future of journalism. Tom, welcome. I'm so glad that you could make it.
Great. It's wonderful to be here.
So, Tom, I'm going to start us out with a few questions, but definitely feel free to, you know, take us in directions that you are passionate about as well. So first and foremost, I think to, you know, set the context of the conversation, you are a veteran journalist. Give us an overview of what, in your observation, what journalism was and what it has become today.
Well, journalism hasn't changed. It's just the amount of journalism has changed. Journalism in the new media world is still has the same principles and the same structure and the same intent as it has in the old media world. The problem is that the business model for supporting that journalism is changing, and it's changing very rapidly. It's actually changing more rapidly for the new media companies than it is for the old media companies, because paradoxically, the old media companies still have print cushion the blow of the change. And we've been transitioning from a print-based business model for the last 10 years, and that transition still hasn't completed itself. But for some of the new media companies who began with digital, they were digital first, the move towards mobile media is really challenging for them. And it's a challenge that not all of them will be able to meet.
So if you extrapolate from where we are, where is this going to end up?
Well, when I left the Financial Times 10 years ago, I thought within 5 years we'll probably find a new business model and everything will be back to normal. We'll have a thriving independent media industry. That didn't happen after 5 years, and I was thinking maybe just needs a few more years. It still hasn't happened. And this is just the continuing race to the bottom now. And the two business models that have shown some effectiveness, advertising and paywalls, are fundamentally flawed. And there's no way that they can support thriving media industry. You've got to get BuzzFeed type numbers, which is in the 100 million unique views a month or so, in order to play in that field. And that can't support, for example, a local news outfit or many others.
So we are on the subject of business models. You know, I've been observing this as long as you have been as well, and if granted from a very different viewpoint, but you know, the ones that seem to me as viable businesses today are Wall Street Journal, The Economist, you know, maybe CNN, and Wall Street Journal and The Economist are both very heavy-duty subscription models, right? They have solid subscription businesses. What are your, you know, what are your thoughts about that pure subscription business model?
Well, it can support small publications like those, but it can't. It's not a business model that's available to anybody else really outside those. The financial news industry is quite a rich industry. It can support those kinds of publications, but we don't have a common media business model that say a local newspaper could use or a local news organization. And the problem with paywalls too is that why would you cut yourself off from the best feature of the internet itself, the amazing distribution of your content? I don't know if you remember the blue dress story from a few months ago. Was it blue? Was it yellow? I went ballistic viral, and I kind of tongue-in-cheek said that this proves Foremsky's first law of media, that content is near infinitely scalable. With one story, I could potentially imprint the entire internet, and it would be carried to the far reaches of the internet by other people's servers and networking equipment. For me as a tech company to have that kind of clout, I would have to build a gazillion data farms and so on. So content is amazingly scalable. Why would you build a table to cut yourself off from this fantastic feature of the internet?
So you're saying that even though the Wall Street Journal and the Economist are viable businesses in the financial news or business news sector, Economist a bit broader than that, but you're saying that the limiting of that content is negative because it's not really taking advantage of the distribution. But the other side of the coin is that lack of viability of other business models, as you were pointing out earlier, that mobile has completely killed the advertising business model, and there is no other business model. So how the hell do you support a company?
Well, I think it's going to come about in an interesting way. It's going to come about through corporate media, through this native advertising, if you will, which I hate, because I think native advertising, for example, in the New York Times, just reduces the trust you have in that publication. And in fact, there's been surveys that have shown that readers reading native advertising think less of the publication that it's in, but they think more of the brand that it's advertising. So here we have brands that are deliberately poisoning the well. They're reducing the trust in, say, the New York Times by publishing native advertising, and yet their advertising has to run in publications like that. So they're shooting themselves in the foot. But the New York Times, in my view, by running that kind of native advertising, is shooting itself in the foot and in the brain, too.
But the New York Times, in particular, is becoming unviable. I mean, they're doing that. They're shooting themselves in the foot because they're having real trouble surviving, right?
Yes, yes. But then readers are going to be thinking, well, everything is corrupt, really. Everything they read in the New York Times or anywhere. In fact, that's generally the way people are looking at media these days, because the media industry is struggling. It's trying to make a penny here, a buck there. However, native advertising shouldn't be the way. It hasn't helped the New York Times. It's still losing money, for example. But, however, since people think everything is corrupt anyway in the media industry, well, start off with a corrupt magazine. Everything's paid for in this magazine, if you will. But supposing that magazine can then, from the profits of the paid-for content, hire a small newsroom and have independent journalists writing independently produced news that isn't paid for. And I think through corporate media, we'll be able to restart an independent media industry. Because corporate media has many advantages. For one, it doesn't have to rely on advertising. Corporate media makes something.
Is the advertising. Corporate media is the advertising. So,
yeah.
Tom, let me pause for a second and explain to the audience a bit of this complexity. I'm not sure if everybody is on the same page with you and me on this corporate media and native advertising thing. So, folks, what's happening out there is that, you know, the newspapers and the, well, on digital media properties can't sustain themselves with advertising because mobile advertising rates are shitty, and that's where the maximum traffic is nowadays. And then there are no subscription business models because people want everything for free. The internet has become a gigantic free rider problem. Nobody wants to pay for anything.
Nobody wants to pay for any media, any journalism, say. However, special interest groups will gladly pay for the media they want you to read, right? We won't pay $1.50 for the New York Times or whatever, but special interest groups will gladly pay for that media, for us to read it. So,
journalism is becoming skewed and biased.
Yeah. And with native advertising, these are articles that look like they've been written by independent journalists, but they're not. They're actually paid for by the company. So there's a little marker saying paid for by Dell, for example. Well, supposing Dell gets a really great story in the New York Times, does it have a little marker that says not paid for by Dell? You know, everything starts becoming looking corrupt. And so when we have less trusted sources of information in society, we're going to run into problems. We've got important decisions to make about a lot of subjects, energy, the environment, the economy, education, elder health care, and those are just the things that begin with the letter E. special interest groups are going to take advantage of this, and in some ways they are. In many ways that we aren't seeing because of the demise of the fourth estate. This is the part of, this is the media. This is what watches society, makes sure the rich and the powerful aren't taking too much advantage of everybody else.
Right, and the rich and the powerful can actually finance this native advertising trend and do all kinds of propaganda on whatever subject, whatever special interest that they want to support.
Yeah. I wonder how native advertising is going to work in the upcoming elections, because we'll say one party be creating a native advertising that looks like it's being written by independent political journalists, will the New York Times allow that? The contradictions for native advertising just don't make sense, and it's not going to end up well. The brands lose out, and also the media brand itself loses out.
The media brands have no other source of survival. I think that's what's creating this kind of apocalyptic situation, is that what is the future of the New York Times? If you were running New York Times, what are you going to do? How are you going to make New York Times survive?
Right. You don't do it through native advertising. You don't do it through a process that reduces trust in your brand. I mean, that is ridiculous. And the management does not understand the environment of its industry. It doesn't even understand the value of trust in a publication. And that trust is built very slowly over time. I mean, the New York Times, I think it's well over 30, 40 years old. Financial Times is about 125 years old. It takes a long time to build that trust.
Yeah.
So why would you play with it? Why would you risk losing that trust with a reader? It doesn't make any sense. The New York Times is selling its future for a handful of beans. And in this story, there's no golden goose. There's just more pain in the newsroom. And you know, it boggles my mind that their management is so blind and stupid to this.
So what do you make of the implosion of GigaOM? That is a brand that had accumulated a lot of trust and was doing a lot of good work, but basically completely poofed.
Yeah, and that was a surprise, because I think just a year previously they had raised another round. They seemed to be doing well on the research side. They were having to do conferences and so on, like every other new media company does. And then it just went poof. And, you know, clearly there was something else going on there, I think, that we don't know about. But it was kind of interesting, because one of the reporters, Matthew Ingram, writes about media quite a lot. And he's always very pro-digital and so on and so on. And making fun of New York Times and paper, and yet, you know, they pulled the rug out from under him in just seconds. He was working on a story, got a phone call, boom, we're done. And the thing is that I've always said that the disruption doesn't stop at the new media companies. They're still in the pathway of the ongoing disruption in the media industry. And the transformation to mobile is happening faster for them than the transition from paper to digital.
So, you know, my two cents on GigaOM is that it raised too much money. It raised like $50 million almost, I think, when, you know, all was said and done in the 10 years that it's been in existence. And if you contrast that with the TechCrunch, for instance, TechCrunch was built with very little money. It was like maybe at the most it was $500,000, probably less than that Michael Arrington and Kip Thayer put in. And they built it to significant revenue, sold it to AOL. That from a venture point of view is actually a success story. Now, if you put $50 million into a company, then you have to generate return on investment, generate revenue at a level, generate valuation at a level that is way, way higher. And given that the fact that the business models of the industry don't really work, it's kind of an unworkable situation. That's why I think GigaOM went out of business.
Well, I think that's part of it, but part of it is the business economics of the industry, which continues to
change. That's what I'm saying. It's the business economics of the industry that don't work, and at some point investors wake up to that and it's like, well, you know, this company is just burning money and we can't really make it work.
Sure, but it's strange that it happened so quickly after raising a round, as the investors clearly had seen the books and so on and seen whatever momentum was going on there. And this also brings about the conversation about, well, long-form content and quality journalism, that's what's needed. And Google has said that, and search bot, you know, rewards quality. But really, does it? Not really. A click is still a click is a click. And one of the biggest disappointments of the internet is that all these computer scientists and experts and so on over at Google and everywhere haven't yet figured out a way to recover the value of a great piece of content. You know, we don't have a mechanism of recovering that. A click is a click is a click.
And yeah,
so any web page.
That's right. You know, one of my favorite, one of the companies that I think is doing very nice work on long-form content is The Atlantic. And I actually don't know what their financials are, or how they're doing in terms of monetization, and whether they're going to survive or not, or are they facing the same kind of survival and existential challenges as everybody else. But they certainly do nice work in terms of long-form content, deep journalism.
Sure, yeah. And the thing is that the revenue, you have to run to keep to stand still for these companies. And, you know, I saw the writing on the wall many years ago after I left the Financial Times. There's no way that the old world can really jump this chasm into this new world. Economics just don't stack up. And really, it's going to, and I realize it's going to continue. The devaluation of advertising is still continuing. The dirty little secret of Google is that it's not very good at advertising, but it does a huge amount of it, so some of it gets through. But for anybody else, it's impossible to compete with Google. And Google is a media company. I've said this for the last decade. Now people understand that better. But Google, Facebook, and Twitter, they publish pages of content with advertising around it. What's not a media company about that? Yeah, they use a lot of tech to do that, but you can't buy a piece of tech from any of these companies. You can buy a chip from Intel, you can buy a database from Oracle. Okay, you can buy a search appliance from Google. That's I suppose a Google Chromebook. But it's not, these are media companies. And the web is a two-way internet. Internet 1.0, we could publish to anything with a computer screen. It didn't matter if it was a mainframe or if the computer was in your pocket. Internet 2.0 is that every screen now can publish back. Back comments, publish back video like we do. So it's a two-way internet. So this is what makes all the social happen. People used to ask me, what's the next big thing? And I said, well, it's blogging. He said, what? what do you mean? What somebody had for lunch that day? Is that it? I said, no, it's a platform. It's a two-way platform. This is now, we're off to the races.
So, Tom, are you following the experiments at Forbes? I used to work with Forbes, so I kept the cursory eye on Forbes. What do you think of what they're doing?
I think that they value the brand something astonishingly, but the whole goal was to be able to package up the company and then sell it, I think, to that Asian media group. I'm not quite sure what exactly happened, but they sold it for a pretty penny. Now, you know, Forbes still has a, you know, a legacy reputation. However, it's difficult to tell who's, you know, the free riders and who's the staff riders. Well, you can actually tell because of the quality of content, but I feel that Forbes just really sold their own brand down a river and greatly devalued it. A little bit
so
like
how do you view user-generated content? Of course, Huffington Post is the biggest success story in that field. Huffington Post built this in huge traffic base based on user-generated content. And frankly, some of the user-generated content is very good. Some of it is crap.
Sure, so, yeah. But, you know, we're the ones that we have to, like, sort the good from the crap when editors and newspapers, you know, used to do that for us. We now have to do that ourselves. And so we're getting better at doing that. The great thing is that people are very media savvy these days. They know what clickbait is and so on. And they really get angry with people. And I think, and again, corporate media doesn't have to have clickbait. It doesn't have to put people in bikinis to get traffic. Corporate media really doesn't even want to publish something that's not true or spin or anything. It actually wants a conversation about the industry it's in, the products that it's producing. It wants to take part in that. So, and again, so this is why I think that corporate media potentially could even produce better quality media than the mainstream media right now, because it's struggling so much for the traffic that it's trying to stand up half-baked stories and tons of clickbait, which is putting people off. Oh, and native advertising too.
And the whole business model of Vox and BuzzFeed and Verge, all these guys are, the huge part of that is corporate media, and these are, Vox and BuzzFeed have both raised serious amounts of money and are doing serious traffic. What are your thoughts about those two or that trend?
Yeah, well, there's not too many that can play in that box. I mean, Vox and BuzzFeed and so on. It's not a business model that's available to many other people. And what we really need is a thriving media industry. We have to have a competitive media industry. We need many media sources. San Francisco used to have a dozen daily newspapers. Now it can barely support one and a half, say. So unless these companies are able to thrive, and also not thrive on billionaire handouts like Warren Hellman giving $5 million here, and so on and so on. It has to be supporting, and it has to make money. And there's nothing wrong with making money out of media, despite all the moves towards non-profit status for media companies, for example. Well, they're not making a profit anyway. And we need to develop a business model that works no matter where you are, and that can support a thriving and competitive industry. And we're nowhere near having that.
I've thought a lot about this corporate media. The other side of that coin, terminology-wise, is content marketing, right? When a corporation or an enterprise is looking at building media content, they're thinking about it as content marketing. And it's incredibly effective, actually. But it is limited. You know, content marketing is not going to support the war in Syria.
Well, content marketing, that comes out of every company is a media company, which I coined that term almost a decade ago, because I saw that as the media industry shrinks, companies are going to have to take on more of the role of telling their own story, right? Which is fine. But so now every company is a media company is well understood, and the whole content marketing boom is based on that. However, they're missing a fundamental point, which I've only just recently been reminding them about it, is that companies, media companies don't write about themselves all day long or you know, just video about themselves all day long. They provide a service. You know, Financial Times provides a financial news service. So every company's a media company, fine. But you've got to find a media service you can provide your community, your industry, or whoever you're trying to reach. And if that content is self-serving, well, that's really marketing. It's not, and that, the problem with content marketing is that a lot of it looks like marketing, and it shouldn't. And also another problem that companies face in producing this content, media content, is that it's hard.
It's very hard. Producing good content is very hard, and I think most of the companies out there that claim to do content marketing do a very poor job of it. And then some of it is limited by what they have to produce content on. If you're selling a toothbrush brand, how much good content can you produce on a toothbrush?
Exactly. I was on a panel last year with one of the comms directors from, I think it was Hyundai, you know, the Korean car manufacturer. And he said, yeah, we're pushed to have a 24/7 newsroom, but even I'm bored with all the stuff about us all day long. Well, exactly. You need to find a service that you can provide your community. Because then also you don't have to write about toothbrushes all day long yourself. You provide a service. And also, if you're able to provide a media service that is popular, that becomes popular and so on, it's very difficult to force you out of it. A competitor can't really just come along and force you out of it. It's like, you know, some people complain to me about TechCrunch. Well, they still go and read TechCrunch because you have to, because it's the largest publication in the tech sector. And that's the same thing with every company as a media company. If you can establish yourself in that pole position, it's incredibly valuable, incredibly valuable. But companies don't know how to be media companies, and it's unsustainable and unreasonable to expect them to become really good media companies.
So, Tom, you have a question from the audience. Folks, when you ask questions, please set your chat to send to all participants. Do not send private messages to me. This is, you know, it's the public roundtable. So the question, however, it came to me privately, Tom, I'll read it out, is can Tom briefly explain native advertising?
Sure, yeah. So native advertising is an article that looks as if it was written by the journalists of that publication. The format and the presentation is usually made slightly differently. I think the New York Times uses a different font. But, for example, the New York Times native advertising is prepared by the advertising group of the company. The journalists have nothing to do with it. So that sets up an interesting schism there, for example. They're allowing content that looks like it's written by their newsroom, but it's not controlled by their newsroom. And although it says paid for by Dell, for example, the whole premise of it is to disguise it as if it were a piece of independent journalism, which is outrageous in just that regard. And also, the brand, for example, Dell, is subsuming its own brand to try and look as if it's coming from the New York Times. And I don't understand brand wants to subsume its own brand on another brand, or that the media brand wants another brand to kind of hijack its own trusted reputation in that way. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And I'm surprised that there hasn't been a larger outcry over
backlash.
This practice. Yeah,
it's disingenuous, I mean, and it kind of erodes the main, you know, asset that a media company like a New York Times, for example, has built over such a long time is trust. And once you lose that trust, it's not easy to rebuild that trust.
Yeah, and New York Times is one of the few trusted media organizations out there. Yes, they occasionally mess up, but they have very high standards and produce great work. If we start losing those types of trust media organizations, then we're going to be in trouble, or bigger trouble than we are now.